Hi, this is Aislinn Antrim from Pharmacy Times, and you're listening to Study Break, a podcast series dedicated to pharmacy students. Each month, we speak with faculty, administrators, and students themselves to bring you the latest news and trends from pharmacy schools across the country. The pharmacy field is changing every day, and students are at the forefront of innovation. Before we begin, do you know the answer to this pharmacy fact? What was the first antibiotic used by clinicians? Stay tuned to find out the answer. This month, I spoke with Savannah Sparks, a pharmacist who is also an international board-certified lactation consultant. We talked about the unique combination of PharmD and IBCLC, as well as what she calls accountability work on TikTok. With 900,300 followers and 31 million likes, Savannah is using social media to tackle disinformation. So to get started, can you introduce yourself and a little bit about what you do?
Sure. My name is Savannah Sparks, and I am a pharmacist as well as an international board certified lactation consultant. And I own my own business as of summer of 2019, and I have loved it.
Great. How did you get interested in the IBCLC certification?
So I had my baby in early 2019, and the introduction into parenthood as well as lactation was very unexpected. I had a very hard time, and I felt like if I, as a healthcare provider, had that much issue getting into parenting and breastfeeding and just adjusting to that transition, I figured a lot of people might. And so I started developing the passion for supporting families by supporting myself and seeking that help. And then I started feeling like I could do it and supporting other families. So I started training, I started reading, I started shadowing, and now I have a full-blown business and I haven't looked back.
How have you found that the IBCLC certification relates to your work in pharmacy?
Well, I feel like there isn't a lot of support for pregnancy, parenthood, and lactation as it relates to pharmacy. Last year in 2020, I think it's 3.6 million babies were born to parents. And so with the pregnancy aspect and the postpartum aspect and the lactation aspect, there's a huge population of people who need quality, evidence-based information regarding using medications during pregnancy and lactation. And I didn't get that training in pharmacy school. I don't think anybody really gets that training for this population to an extensive degree in pharmacy school. And then in my training to become an IBCLC, I realized really no aspect of healthcare gets in-depth training for pregnancy and lactation as it relates to medication therapy. So I think it fits in awesome with pharmacy, and it's so critical because I'm one of the only PharmD IBCLCs in the entire country. I think the last time we spoke, I thought I was the only one, but I actually found one more who got licensed the year before me. And she's a retail pharmacist, I think, in North Carolina. So as it stands right now, I've only found one other PharmD IBCLC in the entire United States.
Combining IBCLC and pharmacy is really unusual. Why do you think that is? And should it be more widespread?
I think it's uncommon due to the history of lactation and how support for families has gone in our society and how parents aren't really supported or valued, and neither is lactation. And so I feel like in my training, I have found that lactation training is non-existent in healthcare programs. So you're graduating these healthcare providers who have no basis of knowledge or understanding for pregnant population or lactation. And so I think it's uncommon because it's not valued. It's not valued from a healthcare perspective, and it's not valued from society's perspective, because we make it so hard for parents to be successful in parenting, but also with my primary focus, obviously being on lactation. That's why I think it's just undervalued, because it's not there. It's not, there's not a lot of representation.
Do you have any resources or advice for pharmacy students who might be interested in IBCLC certification?
So I think that if anybody in pharmacy school is interested in lactation, I absolutely think that they should pursue it. I think that in general, all healthcare programs, whether it be PharmD or physician assistants or MDs or DOs, anybody, nurse practitioners, I think there should be comprehensive training just from a didactic standpoint. But if anybody's interested in what I do, there's several pathways to get the certification that I have, which is an international board certified lactation consultant. And it's the highest level of achievement. And if anybody's interested in it, you can check out the IBLCE website, which is the organization that handles the credential. And of the two pathways, or of the three pathways, there's two ways that they could probably achieve this certification while they're in school. One is shadowing as a peer counselor for an accredited program. La Leche League is a big one in the United States. You have to get 1,000 hours with that, or you can mentor with an IBCLC. And I think that requires 500 hours. So it's definitely attainable in pharmacy school. And it would be interesting because we've seen dual PharmD MBA programs. It would be super easy to incorporate a lactation-based program to have, you know, graduate a PharmD IBCLC.
It's time for a quick financial tip from Tim Ulbrich, founder of Your Financial Pharmacist. Budgeting can be intimidating and hard to get started, but getting back to basics can help you get financially organized.
Yeah, you know, budgeting, I think, is one of those topics. We hear the word budget and we're like, ah, really? You know, it seems so restrictive, right? It seems like we're not able to do the things that we want or hope. The way I like to think about the budget really is the execution method and vehicle for how we want to achieve the financial goals that we've defined. Now, I'm never going to say budgeting is fun, right? We all know that it's not super fun, except for a couple, maybe nerds that love this process. But if we think of the budget in that context, that we've got goals that are exciting, hopefully, that, you know, ignite some passion in us, and the budget is simply the roadmap that's going to allow us to achieve those goals, then I think we start to look at that budget or spending plan in a little bit different way, and hopefully a little bit less painful way. And I always encourage folks, don't start with the budget. Don't start with the budget, because it is deflating, right? We look back at our expenses, we start to beat ourselves up, especially as we look back at maybe the holiday time period and some of the expenses that we have. And so I encourage folks, start with the goal and the vision first. So what are three tangible goals that you want to achieve within the next 12 months or within the rest of the calendar year? And, you know, you can think even a little bit longer than that, but short term, what are three goals that you want to achieve? And these might be things that are, you know, very tangible monetarily, such as, hey, I want to increase my emergency fund from, you know, $1,000 to $2,000. I want to pay down my debt by this much. Or I want to put this much away in an investment vehicle like a Roth IRA. And those are important because before we get into the budget, these are then going to be the why and the motivation behind maybe some of the conversations we need to have with ourselves about how much are we spending here? How much are we spending here? And can we free up some of that money to then put that towards these other goals instead? Or what other opportunities are out there to increase our income to allocate new dollars towards those goals, or perhaps even a combination of both? So starting with the goals, three goals for the next 12 months. And then from there, I encourage folks, do a 90-day look back. Once we've done the goals, very important, goals first, 90-day look back of what has been reality before we project what we want going forward. And this is incredibly important because we tend to underestimate how much we're spending in any given category. Human behavior, I do it, you likely do it as well. And so that 90-day look back, even if we want to change some things going forward, is going to hopefully prevent us from being frustrated with unrealistic numbers that we then set in the budget once we do the goals and once we look back 90 days.
Now back to the show. Savannah, I also wanted to talk a little bit about what you do on TikTok. Can you give a bit of an overview about your channel and the type of content that you produce?
So I'm a content creator on TikTok, and originally it was more lighthearted content. And then as I saw the need, my platform diversified and I wasn't just strictly educational. And I have now dipped my toes into accountability. So my platform is equal parts educational as well as accountability.
What has your experience been as you confront mis- and disinformation online and do accountability work?
So it's rewarding in a lot of ways. It's fulfilling in a lot of ways because I have been able to use my privilege to have this platform and to speak out on issues that other people don't get the same opportunity to speak out on. And so I feel like it's my responsibility in a lot of ways to use my voice to highlight a lot of these issues in our community. And so in that regard, it's extremely fulfilling and it's extremely motivating, and I have loved doing it. But on the other hand, a lot of people, when you combat misinformation, they don't like to be held accountable for spreading disinformation. They don't like to be held accountable for saying very problematic things that can be detrimental to patients and patient health. And so while it's fulfilling, social media in general can have a very dark aspect to it because a lot of people like to push back to avoid that accountability.
I think for a lot of us, social media can sometimes feel like a bit of an echo chamber. But do you think it's an effective way to combat misinformation?
I do. I do actually that, you know, and the outcome of the videos that I make, it's different depending on the topic that I'm talking about and how I approach it. And so success to me is reaching at least one person and either changing their mind about something or giving them information or exposing them to something they have never been exposed to. And lactation is a huge one because a lot of people, I'm the first person that they've ever spoken to that is both knowledgeable about lactation and is also sharing their own lactation experience because I've been breastfeeding for 3 years going now. And so I think that it can be super effective to combat misinformation, especially from a lactational standpoint and from a pharmacy standpoint, because it's so misunderstood what pharmacists do, but it's also misunderstood what goes into lactation and what a lactation consultant does.
What's your advice for pharmacy students who might be interested in using TikTok or just social media more generally?
I would say find what you're good at and pursue it. If it makes you happy, if you have a passion for it, pursue it. If you can find a niche in your community, and in my case, it's lactation and misinformation, pursue it. I also would caution pharmacy students who want to have a social media presence that being popular is fine. Being noticed, having that exposure is great because it has afforded me opportunities that I wouldn't otherwise have. But at the same time, exposure also carries with it a negative aspect. So if you're going to have any sort of exposure on social media, I would advise you to talk to somebody who has exposure on social media so that you can arm yourself with the tools necessary when inevitably you get pushback, especially when it's combating misinformation, because there's hot topics with misinformation, COVID misinformation, vaccines. You know, the things that typically get people fired up has a higher potential of pushback. So it's not to dissuade any pharmacy students from getting on social media, but you have to be realistic about what the environment is like. And if you have the spine and the confidence to do it, I would recommend you do it because it's like I said, it's been so fulfilling to have a strong voice for healthcare and for advocacy.
In addition to their coursework, pharmacy students have dealt with the instability and upheaval of the COVID-19 pandemic over the last 2 years. To learn more about this experience, I spoke with Darian Daniel, a P4 student at the Nova Southeastern University College of Pharmacy. So Darian, to get us started, can you just introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Darian Daniel. My friends call me Dee Dee. I'm a fourth year student at Nova Southeastern University in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. You know, prior to pharmacy school, I worked as a research assistant at a pediatric hospital. I worked in education. I'm currently the body class president, and you know, that's so great. It's a nice platform to go ahead and network and get to know, you know, who your classmates are. Currently, I'm applying to fellowships and I'm in the whole interview process. I'm actually a finalist, and you know, that's just such a huge accomplishment. And you know, with that said, I'm looking to go into medical affairs function and industry and see what's all that about.
What has your experience been in pharmacy school during the pandemic?
You know, it affected obviously everybody in the world. And I think it just took us all for such a whirlwind of events. You know, when the pandemic started, my executive board and I, we were in the middle of doing a fundraiser. And then, you know, COVID hit. So we had to start, you know, all of a sudden, whether we liked it or not, you know, we were propelled to this situation where we had to navigate COVID, you know, right on, because we had our fundraiser, we had our product, or, you know, and we had to meet budgets. We had to, you know, set out what we were and our goal was. So, wow, just the social aspect of it was very difficult. You know, we had to start actually mailing our fundraising items. So that was different, you know, things that you would have never expected that were going to happen. And then in terms of the academics, what could I say? It was weird, right? It was very weird not having the opportunity to see your professor anymore, not having that classroom experience. But I think that being part of the millennial generation, we're adaptable. That's, I think, one of our biggest traits in our generation. And I think we were able to adapt. I would say, you know, it was tough. It was a little bit of a learning curve for everybody, but at least me and I would say my friends as well, we adapted. And I see that this is what the new world brings.
The pharmacy field is changing incredibly quickly, and the pandemic has accelerated all of that change. What are your goals as a pharmacist, and how are you preparing for your career?
I think that my biggest goal as of now is really, you know, given that I'm doing the whole fellowship thing, I really want to cultivate my skills in the industry sector, right? Industry and that type of, you know, skill sets that you need are not necessarily taught in pharmacy school. You know, we're taught more like the clinical aspect, the didactics, but not necessarily how to navigate through these big companies. So my biggest goal is to, you know, use that opportunity, that platform to be a fellow, to cultivate those skills in those, you know, 2 years, 1 to 2 years. And then also, I think it's just, again, it's using your knowledge, using your experience, using your sense of adaptability that has happened because of COVID to redirect and reorganize the way some of these big, you know, life-changing medications are delivered to the population. I don't mean necessarily, you know, delivered to the population. I'm saying more, how does the organization, the creation, the development change in response to COVID? So I hope to, again, use my skill sets to navigate all these new territories.
Did you figure out the answer to our pharmacy fun fact? If you said penicillin, you're right. Although people have long known about the power of bacteria and fungi, it was not until 1928 that penicillin, the first true antibiotic, was discovered by Alexander Fleming, a professor of bacteriology at St. Mary's Hospital in London. When cleaning up a variety of petri dishes, Fleming noticed something unusual on one dish. He found that this, quote, mold juice was capable of killing a wide range of harmful bacteria. Along with his colleagues Ernst Boris Chain and Sir Howard Walter Florey, Fleming later won the Nobel Prize in Physiology in 1945 for this discovery. Thanks for listening to Study Break, a pharmacy focused series. Tune in next month to hear about the latest trends and issues for pharmacy students.